This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, September 3rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. For decades, Florida has been one of the most sought-after states in presidential elections. That's because of its large number of electoral votes and because it truly is a swing state. Some of us remember the electoral fiasco of 2000, which ended with George W. Bush winning the state by just over 500 votes. Florida went for Bush again in 2004, then Obama twice, then Trump in 2016. And recent polls show Biden with a slight lead. But the GOP has worked hard to try to transform Florida into a Republican stronghold. Republicans have controlled both houses of the state legislature and the governorship since 1999. Two governors in particular, Rick Scott and today Ron DeSantis, have gone out of their way to suppress voter turnout, particularly among African Americans, and to tighten the party's control on the state. In August, Trump praised Scott and DeSantis for their stewardship of Florida's voting system.
They're so well-run. Florida's a very well-run state. Low taxes, low everything. They've done a great job, really a great job. And the two governors, between the both of them, they've really got a great system of absentee ballots. And even in the case of mail-in ballots, the postal services are built up there. You know, it takes a long time.
Dexter Filkins, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the long history of voter suppression in Florida, the pivotal role the state will play in the presidential election this fall, and how the aftermath of 2020 could be far more chaotic than that of 2000. Dexter, good to have you back.
Hi.
Okay, let's start by me asking you, how is it possible, 20 years after Bush v. Gore, that the problems that plagued Florida then have arguably gotten worse?
Well, I was one of those people who remember Bush Gore, and I was actually there during the recount, during the crazy recount, and hanging chads and under ballots and over ballots. I think that Florida probably, I mean, they had a lot of problems in 2000, of course, but I think the real issue is this, that the elections are so close. It's a huge state, and so every tiny problem is potentially decisive. Just for an example, in 2018, Rick Scott, then the governor, defeated Bill Nelson, the senator, in the U.S. Senate race. And there were 8 million votes cast, and he ultimately won by 10,000 votes, which is right about 0.1%. And so every single tiny problem, which would otherwise be forgotten, is suddenly magnified. So, for instance, they find a box of ballots in a post office, you know, warehouse. What about these? They discover that there was a ballot design in the most heavily Democratic state, and 30,000 people didn't vote for any candidate, which probably means that Senator Nelson would have gotten those votes. So it's things like that. So that these tiny problems suddenly take on an enormous significance because the votes are so close.
And for many people, 2000 seems like ancient history. Actually, last February seems like ancient history. But there are lessons from that debacle in 2000 that are still very relevant today. Can you talk a bit about just what state officials found when they did that recount?
They found any number of problems. I mean, for those of you out there who don't remember exactly, the U.S. Supreme Court actually stopped the final recount and basically handed the victory to George W. Bush. But what came out of it were these basically problems that no one had sort of thought of before. So, for instance, there was a thing called a butterfly ballot. and that's where the ballot opens up on two pages. And so, for instance, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people voted on both pages. And so that essentially nullified their ballots. And so all those got tossed out. Thousands and thousands of ballots. That's one example. And then the really famous one are what is known as hanging chads, which is when these were paper ballots and people, you would punch a hole in your ballot, basically. And then a little flap of paper would sort of, you know, was supposed to go onto the floor. And in many, many cases, they didn't go onto the floor. They just hung there. And so when they were going back and looking at the ballots, there were some where there were two Chads that were hanging off. Who did this person mean to vote for? It was like a bunch of academics like deconstructing like a text in the most postmodern way that you can imagine. What were this person's intentions and what did they really mean? And it was nuts. It was insane. And it was kind of the dawn of our hyper polarized, crazy political era.
And what about the racial dimension?
Well, the racial dimension is extraordinary, and it never really got the publicity that it deserved, because I think it was buried in the much better known hanging chads and the butterfly ballots. But the summer before the election, state officials hired a data company to basically go through the entire voting roll of the entire state, millions of voters, and flag people that were believed to be felons. Because it's illegal in Florida to vote if you're convicted of a felony, or was at the time. The company that the state hired to do this conducted its kind of survey of the voter rolls in the most shoddy and negligent way. It's the only way to describe it. The question is really whether it was intentional. But what they did was they went through and they used a program that if 80% of the letters of a felon's name matched 80% of the letters in a voter's name, then the voter was flagged. So, for instance, you would have a convicted felon named Johnston, and the computer program would flag a voter named Johnson. And so they flagged close to 100,000 voters were initially flagged, and many of them got letters saying, "You're a felon and you can't vote in the election." And it caused chaos. There was a lawsuit afterwards, and it was kind of sorted out. But it's pretty clear that the disproportionate number of those voters were Black, and that at least, I think, 20,000 people were improperly excluded from the voter rolls or incorrectly flagged as being felons. And many of them didn't vote.
You can draw a direct line from then to today. So one of the most important stories about voting in Florida in recent years involves the enfranchisement of formerly incarcerated people. In 2018, a man named Desmond Meade launched a campaign to amend Florida's constitution to make it legal for felons to vote. And a referendum on the issue was approved by nearly two-thirds of voters. And that included, by the way, a large number of Trump voters. Meade himself described it as the largest act of enfranchisement since 1971, when the voting age was lowered to 18. To start with, tell us, who is Desmond Meade?
Desmond Meade was a convicted felon himself, and who became a lawyer, and then started this campaign, I think 2015, to amend the Florida Constitution, which has been in place since 1868, which says if you've been convicted of a felony, you can never vote again. And so he sought to amend the Constitution to say, essentially, if you've been convicted of a felony, but you've served your time, and you're not a murderer and you're not a rapist, essentially the most violent felonies were taken off of that, your rights can be restored. Again, Florida's a southern state with a long and ugly history, and the felony language in the Florida Constitution disproportionately affects Black people. So Meade set out to do this, and initially his campaign was like they didn't have any money, and they were painting slogans on bed sheets. But it gathers steam, and they get tons of money, and they get tons of support. And as Meade told me, he said, we had Democrats, we had Republicans, we had liberals, we had conservatives, we had everybody. And two-thirds of the voters of the state vote to amend the Constitution that essentially allows felons the right to vote.
The referendum passed in 2018 on the night that Ron DeSantis was elected governor, and the Florida state government has done everything to make sure that it did not proceed as expected.
Yeah. So when Amendment 4 passed, almost immediately, DeSantis is now the governor. Both houses of the legislature are controlled by the Republicans. They pass legislation which says essentially that in order to have your voting rights restored, you must, in addition to serving your sentence, pay any fines and fees that were imposed on you at the time of trial, which for many, it's thousands of dollars. And of course, many of these people, if not most, are indigent. And so suddenly, instead of close to a million people having their voting rights restored, it suddenly it's all on hold. And so there's been in Florida this intense fight going on. The ACLU filed a lawsuit, and it's now in front of the 11th Circuit, the federal appellate court in Atlanta. I cannot believe that it will not end up at the United States Supreme Court. But and I think this is the most important point for now, which is that the registration deadline in Florida to vote is on October 5th. And so if this court fight drags on much longer, we've got about a month, then it's not going to matter anyway. So you know, probably it looks like the Republican Party once again is going to be able to kick the can down the road and basically keep these people off the ballot, despite the overwhelming preference of Florida's voters.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The Republican success does depend on limiting access to the polls, and they focus particularly on Black voters. The Voting Rights Act forbids overt efforts to suppress the vote, but Rick Scott, who's now a U.S. Senator, and Governor Ron DeSantis, helped by the legislature, have found all kinds of ways to do it. So with the felons case being only one example, give us an example or two of how they go about this.
Well, I think this is really the kind of the larger story here, because it's not just felons we're talking about here. It's voting rights more generally, and it's not just Florida. It's the whole country. I mean, Florida got a big head start on this, but basically what happened is in 2008, when President Obama won, he put together this coalition of, it was essentially college-educated people, young people, and Black people. And that basically forced the Republicans to kind of wake up. It was a coalition which is big, and it's getting bigger. And the Republicans sort of essentially said to themselves, what can we do? What the Republicans discover is that by making pretty small rule changes with regard to voting, casting ballots, registering to vote, you can essentially achieve a partisan end. This is happening essentially all over the country. And it's really when you start to read this stuff and when you start to talk to people, it's like there's a playbook, and there has to be. I mean, because it's happening everywhere, and it's essentially, the goal is low turnout means Republican victories, basically. And so let's make it harder to vote. So, for instance, in Florida, they start to limit early voting, for instance, which is very popular in the Black community. They made it more difficult to register to vote. They restricted counting rules. The for instance, and this is a hugely important one, which could really, really come into play all across the country on election day, which is if you cast a mail-in ballot or an absentee ballot, it must arrive at the supervisor of elections office by election day. What Democratic lawyers have been trying to do, and which is legal in about a third of the states, is any ballot which is postmarked before the election should be counted. Again, that's legal in about a third of the states. It's not legal in Florida. So here, just to give you an example, in 2018, you had 15,000 ballots arriving after Election Day, and so therefore were not counted. That's greater than the margin of Scott's victory over Nelson. And that's how decisive this stuff is, particularly in when you're going to have a really potentially a close election or a close vote.
So all of this is causing incredible confusion among voters who are trying to figure out, you know, do I trust the U.S. mails, given how they've been stripped of their many of their duties? Do I vote early? Can I vote early? One of Rick Scott's tricks, as I understood it from your piece in 2014, was to ban early voting on college campuses. Do you risk your life by going to vote in person, especially older people, on Election Day?
Yeah, it's terrifying. It really, really is. And I think what's happening right now, and when you hear the president, as he did yesterday, deliver this kind of strange-sounding tirade, vote twice, you know, you can cast an absentee ballot, you can go to the polls, and they'll figure it out, and like, whatever. Well, first of all, that's like illegal. It's a felony in many states. You can't do that. But I think that's intentional. They know exactly what they're doing, and the president knows exactly what he's doing, which is, I'm going to create as much confusion as I can, and by doing that, I'm going to scare people away from the polls. I'm going to make them give up, and because that translates historically into Republican victories.
But DeSantis is currently mired in attacks about his completely disastrous response to the coronavirus. You went to Florida a few weeks ago for your reporting. Tell us a little bit about what you found there and whether it is affecting Republican prospects in the election.
DeSantis, I think it's fair to say he hasn't handled the coronavirus well. The caseloads are gigantic there still. I think what's really interesting right now is that both Trump and DeSantis, their prospects have kind of dropped. And DeSantis's job for the last many months has been, politically, to deliver Florida to Trump in November. That's, you know, job one, basically. And what's happened is that DeSantis has begun to back away, and he's begun to distance himself from Trump. So Trump used to go down to Florida all the time, and whenever he did, he would like appear with DeSantis, and Pence would go down, and they would appear together, and they'd be on the stage together, and that's not happening right now. And I spoke to some people close to Trump and DeSantis who said, basically, DeSantis has decided Trump's not good for him right now, and he's not up for re-election. So one person said to me, Ron's going to tell you that he's doing everything he can for the president, and he'll sound believable, but it's not true, and there's no evidence for it.
You mentioned, Dexter, driving around. I think you were in northern Florida, and what you heard on talk radio.
Yeah, it was really something. So I spent a few days in Tallahassee, which is in North Florida. It's the state capital. There's a big state university there, Florida State. There's a large black population. It's a kind of island in the deep south of North Florida. And then I got in my car and I drove over to Jacksonville. And as I did that, I was driving across the northern part of the state. And just one radio station after another, really, really hard-edged conservative, some of it really crazy, paranoid stuff, but like everywhere. Like it was like every other station I went to, talking in these really apocalyptic terms about what happens if Donald Trump loses. It's a Marxist, Leninist, BLM takeover of the country. It was scary. I mean, I felt like I really, after it took me about 2 hours to drive over to Jacksonville, and I got out of my car and I thought, there's going to be, if Biden wins, there's going to be violence after the election. That was just 1 2-hour drive across Florida. But I had that overwhelming impression.
You wrote Biden can plausibly win the election without Florida, but Trump almost certainly cannot. Could you elaborate on that?
Biden has a path, provided he can win any number of other states that they're kind of counting on winning.
Including the other swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania.
And all the certain ones like California and New York. And whereas Trump basically has to win Florida. You know, it's 29 electoral votes. It's a huge population. Right now in the state, it's very close. Biden was way far up for a while. I think at one point over the summer, he was like 8 points up. Now he's down to 3. It looks like, once again, we're headed for a really close election. That makes me think about the following. Let's say it is. I mean, each side, Biden and Trump, they will deploy thousands and thousands, and I mean it, lawyers trained in election law to the state to argue over votes. And absentee ballots and mail-in ballots are particularly open to challenge because, you know, the two signatures have to match and they have to be opened by hand and counted by hand. And so what with a race that in Florida, which is now increasingly looks like it's going to be razor close, the potential for, I think, chaos and, you know, really, really intense partisanship is looming again in November.
But why have we gotten to this point? I mean, Democrats could hardly have been blind all these years to the systematic ways Republicans have gone about fixing things so that they would continue to maintain control throughout the state. What is the matter with the Democratic Party in Florida?
That's a really good question. I think the short answer is that the sort of manipulation of the voting rules, that's been a way, not so much how the Republicans achieved power, but how they've maintained their power, even though they don't have a clear majority. And so, for instance, I talked to Dan Gelber, who's the mayor of Miami Beach, who was the minority leader in the legislature, a Democratic minority leader. And he said to me, I can have a reasonable conversation with any Republican about anything except voting. And that's when the Darth Vader mask comes up. He said, you can see it. He said, it's like they were all in a room and their consultants said to them, if you want to win, this is how you do it. And so really what's been happening for the last 20 years is that by the really careful manipulation of these super arcane and really kind of boring rules, it's just shaved enough votes here and there that they've been able to stay in power for, you know, however long that is, 21 years. But the Democratic Party, my impression was like they're going to be ready this time. Whereas in the past, they've been caught kind of flat-footed. It's kind of been, in Florida, you can see it, it's been kind of an arms race. And so both sides are kind of locked and loaded, and we'll be ready for November 3rd.
Thanks so much, Dexter.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Forever War, about the American battle against Islamic fundamentalism in Afghanistan and Iraq. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.